There are a few pilots in Alaska who have put in stellar careers. Most of us know them. You see them out here banging around, but rarely do we know more than that they've been out here for about 30 years. And I'd say a good many of them end up getting somewhat grouchy. You got the old grouchy bush pilot syndrome. Well, Vic Olson is a huge exception to that rule. I first met Vic in the late 90s, and he'd already been in Alaska for close to 30 years. And he came up here with 7,000 hours of instruction given time, so he'd done a bunch of flying before he even got to Alaska. And then he put in a career up here flying various different planes, from Skyvans and up to Caravans in his later years, and 406s. And he always did it cheerfully. Like I said, when I worked with him, I was in my low 30s, and Vic was already up in his 60s, and he'd outwork all of us. And you'd get back from a flight and kind of be a little pissy and grouchy about the next flight. You want to go, well, I'd want to go running or go do some of your own stuff. And you'd expect the next flight to be waiting for you. And as you get ready to land, you'd hear Vic taking off. And you'd say, Vic, where are you going? And he'd be like, well, I just saw that pallet of mail sitting there. And boy, somebody sure had to get it up to Shishmaref. And there'd go your flight. He'd outwork all of us any day of the week. And even on his days off, he'd get called in, and you'd be heading out in some crappy weather with an overloaded caravan, pissy and grouchy, and you'd hear Vic take off again. And you'd say, Vic, what are you doing? And he'd say, well, you know, they needed someone to fly this plane, and sure was nice for them to give him a great plane to fly on a day like this. So, like I said, he's a true class act. And last summer, I finally had a chance to sit down with him and talk about his whole career in aviation. And that was pretty awesome. I think anyone you ask in the Nome, Kotzebue area, they would all point to Vic and say, that's how I'd like to end my flying career. He's an awesome guy, so enjoy the interview. This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm sitting down with Vic Olson at Nome City Field in Nome, Alaska. That's out in western Alaska on the Seward Peninsula, almost within sight of Russia. And Vic's been flying out here for... boy, since the mid-70s.
76.
Okay. Yeah. So we're just going to talk about Vic's career in Western Alaska and what it's like to be a long-time Western Alaskan resident and pilot. So to start with, you're from Coos Bay, Oregon, originally.
Yeah, actually, that's where I was working last when I headed for Nome.
Okay.
At Coos Bay.
I thought you were born and raised in Coos Bay.
Actually, I was born and raised in a little place called Grants Pass.
Oh, Grants Pass.
Down the Rogue River from it, a place called Galice is where I really grew up.
Okay. I know Grants Pass. I don't know Galice.
Yeah, yeah. I always wanted to be a logger because that's what my father did, and he didn't want me to be a logger, and he worked as hard as he could to get me interested in something else. Yeah.
So he made you a pilot?
Yeah, actually, my principal at the school... when I was in the third grade, Ivory was the guy's name, got me cranked up. I think it was a conspiracy with my father. that's where I really got cranked up on aviation, about the third or fourth grade, and I haven't read anything unless it had something about flying in it since.
Oh, wow.
My education got kind of narrow there.
And stuck with planes ever since.
Yeah.
So third grade, so you didn't think of it on your own. Of course, this would have been back in the, what year, roughly?
Third grade, you're 9 years old. I'm born in 39, so that would have been about 48, is that right?
Would be about right, yeah.
Yeah,
so, and aviation wasn't really big in the late 40s.
No, it was, I guess the onslaught, or near the end of the Second World War,
interest picked up.
Interest picking up there.
Yeah,
and everything.
So your principal of your school knew about it.
Yeah,
and
yep.
Pushed it on you.
He was really pushing aviation.
Okay.
There was another friend of mine. We grew up went to school together that also went off onto this aviation, but just the two of us out of the whole class. It wasn't all that big a class.
I was going to say, how many people?
Yeah, there was probably about six or seven of us there in the class, you know.
Well, that's a whole third.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Your principal a pilot?
He wasn't a pilot, but he just was really interested in a lot of model airplanes.
And Lindbergh would have been a huge hero.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. excellent. We read that half a dozen times, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
Lindbergh's story about it. Yeah.
So when did you actually start flying then? I mean, if you were interested.
The cost of flying was so, you know, I just didn't have the money for it. I went into the Air Force and got in on maintenance, aircraft engine.
Okay.
And, gee, I started out working on B-36s, as a matter of fact. I engine mechanic on a B-36. And then the B-52s replaced the B-36 and the KC-135s working on the engines. And then I cross-trained into electronics and started getting into aircraft radio and that sort of stuff.
Okay.
And then on the side time, wherever I could get a couple of bucks saved up at the aero clubs, whatever, I'd take a lesson here and a lesson there and here a lesson, there a lesson type thing.
Was that an Air Force aero club?
Yeah.
What planes did they?
Oh, Cessna 150s, J-3 Cubs. You go around for a different place and it got different machinery.
Whatever they had.
Finally, I got into, I was at Castle Air Force Base there in Merced, California, and the flying club there was really aggressive, and I just went out and worked in the shop on my time off and traded my time, mechanic time, for flying lessons.
Okay, so you'd go to the aero club and work on the planes and get some flight time. So that's when you finished up your ratings.
Yep, that's how I got my private anyway. And then after I got out, I had the GI Bill.
Finished up my commercial and
instrument and ATP. Matter of fact, I had my commercial and my instrument before the GI Bill started. I used the GI Bill to get my ATP, is the way it was. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was, so you're still
at Coos Bay when I did that, yeah.
Were you based in Coos Bay still?
No, I just went over there and used their
facilities.
I had a little operation at Newport, Oregon. I was there almost 9 years, I guess.
Doing flying or renting?
Flight instructing and charters and...
Oh, your own little airline.
Yeah, own little operation.
That would have been in the 60s?
Yeah. 68. Late 68 I started. And I worked there until about a year before I came to Alaska. Went down and worked at Coos Bay for about a year.
What was, when you ran your operation in Newport, in terms of regulations and rules...
It was a different world. The FAA that I grew up with there, when the FAA come to town, we had a big potluck, and everybody come out, and we had a big, basically a big potluck, and you could talk to the FAA, and if you had something haywire, you'd leave your drawers open, the records. If they found a malfunction, they'd tell you about it, and it damn better be fixed when they come around next time.
You know? Right, they'd help you, they'd work with you on
yep,
it.
Yep,
Brian Weckworth's in town. And he's actually going back the other way. I think he's actually...
Working that way?
He's really interested in actually... Give him a few more years. Not that there's anything wrong with the FAA, but...
Right, yeah, there's been, you know, the... We the people probably are the big problem, you know. I mean, you see some of the things that people do, and then you wonder, well, no wonder the FAA gets kind of upset. They're probably sick and tired of pulling stuff out of wrinkled aluminum here and there, you know. So
In '68, it was a very good working relationship. And you just basically you'd buy a couple planes and start your own flight
school. Right. That's about the way I started.
Yeah, if you're operating
anybody, flights. Yep.
So you instructed for a couple years then?
Yeah, matter of fact, when I came to Alaska, I had 5,000 hours in the right seat of a Cessna 150 all by itself, just trying to learn how to teach people how to fly. Yeah.
Oh, I got to ask you now then, how much flight time do you think you have now?
Oh, God, I don't have any idea.
But if you had 5,000 in 70, it's got to be a lot.
Janice kind of went over my books when I went on with Haglund's back in 01.
Uh-huh.
I was about 27,000 then. What she figured.
Well, I'm sure it's
might have cracked the 30. That was kind of my goal. My old one of my early flight instructors or mentors, I guess, in the You know, he had about 30,000 hours, and I thought I'd try to at least do that much. And
I think you cracked that.
I might have caught up with him there anyway, yeah.
That's that captain I flew at Everest was the same way. He wanted to crack 30,000. Then he's like, well, I'm going to retire when I hit 40. When he hit a number, it was like 41,000 and he, or a date. And he ended up retiring like 200 hours short or something. It was interesting. So with your job in Coos Bay, so you were done flight instructing in Newport, and you just stayed on the Oregon coast and just went south a little bit. And that was working for a company then?
Coos Aviation, they called it.
Okay, flying...
Mostly Cessnas. They was a Cessna dealership.
Okay.
Yeah, and then we had a twin Comanche, and let's see, I guess they had five or six Skymasters. One of them was a pressurized Skymaster. That was really a neat airplane.
Yeah.
And 206s were just kind of, the 205s and the 206s were just kind of coming into their element about right. that time, I think. So I had a couple of 206s.
And what was the flying? Did you...
Mostly flight instructor. And I had go to work and just maybe put 3-4 students a day, you know, with their pre and post flight and that kind of stuff, and an hour or so of flying, and you're just
cranking out the students.
Yeah. I think it was $12 a flight hour or something like that. Anyway, it was enough to where I was able to buy a house, and in that day, it was a livable wage.
I think there's some instructors now who make $12 a flight hour.
Yeah, I don't know. That sounds. Yeah.
So, what brought you to Alaska? How'd you end up?
It's really a long story of what got me headed this way, but in a nutshell, I made a trip to Wichita with a 402 hauling a bunch of pilots out, and the company had bought five or six new airplanes.
Okay.
And so we took the pilots out, they all grabbed an airplane and flew it back, and I was in the middle of my ATP training. Or at the end of my ATP training, and my instructor, old Joe Miller, that's a story all by itself. Anyway, on the way back, we got tangled up in a bunch of thunderstorms coming over the Rockies, and Anchorage Center's radar wasn't working, and Joe stopped us at Denver until it got dark, and then we took off in the dark, and we fly off over the mountains, and you hear this... You'd see the little light from the lightning, you know. And so you see that? You turn right there, you know. What? That's where the lightning's at. And he says, no, where you don't see the reflections, where all the rain and everything is, you know. So he flew us through that we didn't hit a bump, you know. But it scared me enough when I got back to Coos Bay. I checked my instrument manual from FAA, and it says Alaska, zero thunderstorms. 2 weeks later, I was in Nome, Alaska. Yeah.
So I think you told me that story once before, but you didn't have any radar, of course. So in the thunderstorm,
we didn't have any radar in the airplane. No.
Yeah, and his strategy was when you see lightning, just go right for it.
Yeah, because that's where you know there's an opening in the clouds.
Right.
There,
yeah.
So, yeah. When you think about it, it makes sense, but it scared the hell out of me at the time. You know, I just. But we didn't hit any. Yeah, we went through there, and
so it worked.
Anchorage Center, you heard, or Anchorage Center,
Denver
Center. I can't remember the centers. That was a year or two ago. Yeah. Anyway, they were having a hell of a time with the airlines, you know, because the radars that were down, and you know they've got onboard radar, but they was wanting assistance from
center,
and they're grumbling about the turbulence and the. But I don't know, would have been a good thing.
Should have just told him, head right for the lightning, you'll be okay.
Right. Trouble of it is, you know, I haven't tried that. I haven't verified that enough to really know if I ought to tell people that or not. You know, I mean, maybe it just was a fluke that day that we made it through. I don't know.
I don't know. I might be too scared to try it.
Yeah. I'll leave the thunderstorms alone. Well, that's the reason I'm here, you know. We
don't
you know, we got a well, a fender bumper here once in a while, but
yeah, not too much out here in Nome.
Right, right, hardly ever.
Did you come straight to Nome?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And you had a job when you came.
Yeah,
up here?
Yeah. I Munns and Northern Airlines, and okay. My instructor, I got my check right out of the way, and my instructor heard me. This Joe Miller, he heard me with my thirst for an aero commander, to fly an aero commander.
Ah, yep, yep.
I wanted to fly an aero commander so bad, and he says, you know, I know a guy that's got 3 aero commanders that's looking for pilots. Where? Show me where. And it was Munns and Northern here in Nome, Alaska.
Okay.
And I gave a call, and they sent a ticket just like that.
And did the commander live up to your expectations?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Good plane. That was a piston.
Yeah, it was a piston. It geared like homing engines. And,
Yeah,
it was an interesting airplane. But found my favorite airplane here the other day, though. It's the one out there with the wings on it. You know, they're all great. Each one of them had their thing. You know?
I think you're right. I'm still chasing that favorite plane. The reason I'm at Ryanair now is they've got Skyvans.
Oh.
And I'm like, God, I really want to fly a Skyvan. I mean, boy, it can Leah really nice, too, but it's still like, oh, the Skyvan is just so ugly you want to fly it.
Yep, yep. Have you flown it?
I haven't.
You'll be just really, really impressed with that airplane. Probably as nice a flying airplane as I've ever flown.
I actually just did a video of it for the website, and you know, the pilots all love it. They say it's really easy.
Yeah, just a super flying airplane.
I thought it should have performed really well.
Yes.
It's a phenomenal performance.
Yep.
Yeah, they just did a little damage on it, so it's getting fixed now, but that's another story. So that was 76 that you showed up here. You're flying for Munns.
Yeah.
Just sort of a quick overview. How has Nome changed since 76?
In the wintertime, everybody kind of parked their cars, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The snow machines were just starting to, you know, they've been snow machines for a while, but they were just starting to get racy type snow machines. And so everybody had a snow machine. The streets were just kind of cleared enough to keep emergency vehicles.
Okay.
You know, and town pretty well cleared out there, you know, in the wintertime.
Down
there. And then the summertime, everybody you'd kind of hustle and bustle.
Were they still mining out here in the summer?
It was Alaska gold. You didn't see the beach miners then like you do now.
Okay.
There was a few, but it wasn't the big deal like it is now. I think gold was only $32 an ounce or something like that. I can't remember when the price went up on it, but it wasn't that big a...
Wasn't worth doing too
much. Alaska Gold had their dredges. The dredges were running.
Yeah, it's for you guys who are listening in, there are these big dredges out all around Nome that... these big buckets that scoop up...
Bucket lines, yeah. They were just a tremendous piece of equipment.
So you'd watch them operating.
They build their own little pond, you know, and they're floating around in their own little pond, and they got that bucket line on the end of that
long arm
sticks it down and goes right down into the bottom of this. And they build, they just keep moving their pond with them, and they fill it in behind them as they go. Quite an operation.
It is a good operation. Yeah. In terms of the flying here, there was Munns. Were there a lot of operators here?
Munns was it. Munns had a contract for Ween to do the village service.
Okay.
And there was Seward Peninsula was a charter outfit. They had 207s and 206s and 185 or something like that. Huh. And then there was Foster Aviation. They were probably the old timers here.
Right. I've met Richard Foster once.
Yep.
Down as flying a couple.
And then a little later on in that period of time, there was a Nome flying service popped up. But as far as the scheduled mail carrier, it was Munns.
And Ween mainlined everything out here, and then you took it. Same sort of flight you have
Same
now.
Thing we're doing right now.
So just the Bravik Teller, Wales, Shishra.
Same deal.
Stuff.
Just going and going and going.
Yeah. Were the villages kind of the same?
A lot smaller. Everything was smaller.
Okay, yeah. That's the main difference.
Yep.
It's just,
yep.
And probably no running water in the villages.
Yeah, even in Nome, see, a large majority of the the large majority of the houses didn't have water and sewer. Okay. Honey buckets and have water delivery, have a big water tank in the Arctic entry of the house or something like that, you know. Then they'd come by and fill the tank up, and then you'd have a little pump there that pumped the water pressure into your house to where you'd be. It looked like you were downtown operation. But and then you went to the, boy, there was no doubt in your mind when you went to the bathroom with the honey bucket there where you knew you were in the right place, yeah.
So, and there are bars in Nome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you think it was more lively then, or is it?
Yeah, I don't know. Then I patronized more than I do now. What's the old saying? I can work as hard as I always did, and I can play as hard as I always did. I just don't do both of them at the same time anymore like I used to, yeah.
Yeah, and I was just down with some younger pilots in Bethel, and they can still do both.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe things don't change that much.
Yeah.
So with Munns, you're flying the Commanders, and it worked pretty well out here.
Yeah, Islanders and Commander, and the another one of my favorite airplanes was the Dornier, DO-28D1, I believe it was.
Was that the high-wing?
High-wing with engine? The slots and the engines on a pylon on the out of the fuselage.
Yeah, coming out, yeah. I've seen pictures of them. I've never heard. Yeah. So you flew those, too.
Yeah, that was really, really a nice airplane.
A little more coffee?
Sure, yep.
That'll be some more coffee, too. Huh, yep. You've flown all the planes I want to fly.
Yeah.
The Islander I'm dying to fly, I made a video down in McCall, Idaho, recently of an Islander.
Yeah.
Some guys flying it down there.
You might want to be sure and wear hearing protection.
And they rattle like crazy, yeah. Don't they?
Yeah, they're pretty noisy.
I did one flight out there. Yeah, you would like flying in Idaho quite a bit, too.
It's
kind of has similarity stuff here. So what happened to Munns? I mean, they're kind of legendary.
Well, you know, since and prior, I've noticed that as long as the owners are having fun, an airline does just fine. And the second something happens to where the owner's not having fun anymore, the handwriting's on the wall.
Right, yeah.
And there's Brian Gallagher, their son, oldest son, when he crashed out at St. Lawrence Island, that pretty well gutted the company. That really, really hurt the...
And so it kind of after that, it just sort of faded away.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
And they ended up selling the company to Ryan.
Okay, so Ryan bought Munns.
Yeah, yeah.
Who bought Foster's? Was that Baker's?
I don't think anybody. Cape Smyth.
Cape Smyth
bought Foster's.
And Bering Air bought Nome Flying Service.
Nome Flying, yeah. Actually, yeah, yep, yeah.
And Olson, was Olson Air?
Olson Air, they've been here, yeah.
For a long time.
Yep, yep. Okay. They were originally out of...
Gullivan.
Gullivan, yeah.
That's right. They're an old flying family.
Yes.
Along those lines.
Yep, yep.
Cool.
Martin Olson was... Boy, you talk about a hard-working boy. He really...
Was he?
Yeah. Yep.
I know Donnie Olson. I don't know the rest of them.
Yeah, they all hard-working.
Yeah, that with an unfortunate history. And
yeah, you know... I don't know. That's... They really have had a bad
string of luck.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of talking along those lines, not specifically about accidents, but since the 70s, I mean, you think it? I don't have any statistics, but you feel like it's gotten safer flying out here, or has it just changed? And with modern technology, people just change their minimums.
A little bit of all of the above, I'd say. First off, there's a lot of ridiculous things that we used to do that we don't do anymore.
Right, less oversight, so less interest in...
Yeah.
You could kind of just go, I imagine.
Yeah, like, yeah, you're... I don't know, we used to do some pretty stupid things. And another thing that's really, really helped make it safer is the weather reporting.
Okay.
We had some good weathermen back in those days, but they just didn't have the tools to work with.
Right. That's even gotten better in the 5 years since I was up here really full-time.
Yep.
There's an AWAS at every
village. Yep, there's just no question what the weather is, where you're headed. ring them up and it's there, you know. And right. and the weather cams at a lot of these places, you can see what the weather is there, you know. You don't have to, no, very few guessing. And
yeah, the agent says, two of our checks. You say, yeah. And they, oh, the weather's good.
Yep.
Now you can go and check the weather cam and say, yeah.
Yeah, right. Right. Okay, clear means I can see clear across the street. Yeah. 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 No, that's the whole attitude has become more professional, I think.
Okay.
I think it, and, you know, GPS hasn't replaced sex yet, but it's getting up high on the list. That really makes a difference because in the past, we didn't have any option except for the scud run.
Right.
You know, because how are you going to get down on the other side, you know?
Yeah.
And now, with GPS, you can pop up and get above all this garbage.
And especially if you're gonna, and the planes have gotten better.
Yeah, yeah.
The turbines and
yeah, power. Oh, yeah, yeah. Like that thing we got now, that 406, man, you know, and the 1900 and yeah. and the Caravan. Geez, you know, that's, they're just all super machines.
Yeah. They, yeah, I love that Caravan. I'm just flying a 406 again for BSSD.
Yeah.
It's a good airplane.
Yeah.
That's a really nice plane. Yeah, I caught that last year or two before the GPS really started taking over.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember in Bethel I was flying and you'd take NDB headings and,
right.
you know, a VOR as long as you keep it, then you'd pick up the next one.
Yeah. Yeah, we used to go to the St. Lawrence Island with an NDB here at Nome and pick a course. And, I don't know, I've always just pull wrecks off the mountains between Medford and Roseburg for a couple of years before I, while I was getting my licenses and see what happens when people fly into the side of a mountain. So I could never go out and then descend on the clock out there. I always went out underneath. And it amazed you how you can see the water and determine, you know, you're, well, gee, the wind, you know, they make me, I make this correction, you know,
oh,
and
yeah.
all I got's the NDB behind me at Nome. And how accurate you can be at 140 miles out there to Savanga, you know?
Yeah, and it's a big island, but it's not enormous.
Right, right.
So there were no
well, you're
going
to hit the island, but the idea is it's nice to
hit the village.
Right. Yeah, it kind of looks nice if you're not humping up and down the beach to your passengers, you know. But yeah, you'd fly until you're about 15 minutes of landfall, and if you could still see. As long as you can see far enough to turn around, you know, you just stayed there. It might be 50 foot off the water, you know. I mean, but
right.
hell of a lot safer than going up and then descending down through on the clock and descending into the mountains, you know.
Or missing the island.
And the second you got to where you didn't have enough visibility to turn around, you pop up and get a 4,500 foot to where you're above everything and then fly out your time. If you don't see anything that's safe, you turn around and bring the load back.
Right. That's...
Yeah.
Well, that's where I think GPS is actually could potentially make things less safe because people are more inclined to say, well, it's really bad, but I can get in because I'm GPS.
Yeah.
That was kind of what I was wondering. Has it made things safer or worse, or is it, it's probably helped overall.
Yeah, I think it's done away with that scud running. See,
yeah.
I mean, that
yeah.
scud running...
you can hit stuff.
Yeah, you know, everybody's so worried about the ice. Boy, you hear... Boy, everybody's scared to death of the ice, huh? Well, you know what? They're scared to death of the ice because they've heard all these horror stories about the ice. And how did they get horror stories about the ice? Everybody was survived it to come back and tell the story.
That's...
The one that's killing, you know, I got six guys here that I've known that aren't around to drink a beer with anymore because they just didn't quite hit clear a ridge or a hill that they knew exactly how high it was, and they
right.
knew exactly where it was at, but they're doing this scud running underneath it, and that's what all the people I've seen that have got it here on the Nome Seward Peninsula area, they got it flying into the side of a hill.
Well, you have hills around here.
You sure do.
Yeah, I'm like, you
they're
know,
kind of solid, too. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I'm just saying, yeah. being back down at Bethel, there aren't that many hills, and it's
right.
easier to do
yeah.
some things.
Yeah.
But I think things have changed. And I actually picked up in just the last 5 years. I think the attitude out here has
yeah.
gotten, and in Bethel has changed quite a bit. People are much more inclined to wait.
Yeah, yeah.
And say, no, we don't. We have the weather out there.
Yeah.
We have all this reporting.
Yeah.
We can wait until it gets good. And we'll head
yeah.
on out.
Yeah, I don't know. You just when the preacher's out there complaining because you're taking his job away. What do you mean I'm taking your job away? Well, you scare the hell out of more people than I can preach. That's an indication you might be pushing things a little too hard.
Right,
you know.
Yep.
Back away and yeah.
So let's back up again. That's a nice little deviation. So after Munns, then after Munns, you stayed with them till they sold.
No. I picked up a chance to go to work for an outfit in Gifford Aviation was the name of the outfit. They had a bunch of Skyvans.
Oh.
And they had three twin otters also, and I had opportunity to do that, so I went and did it.
And where was that?
They were at Merrill Field there in Anchorage.
Okay.
And so I moved the family to Anchorage. We bought a trailer house there. Out by Jacksonville Park there, or what, I can't remember the name of the place now. But I was never there. That was the disadvantage of that job, is it would, you know, I mean, all the time I was there, I only flew in and out of Merrill Field for maybe three or four times out of a 2 year
tour. Were they, was it pipeline stuff?
We had a sky van up at Camp Lonely that was working with National Petroleum Reserve. They were doing a bunch of test drilling up there, checking on that. So we were supporting that with the sky van. So you either went there, or we had a roving sky van that went up the down the West Coast for primarily for Ween, for Kotzebue, Nome, and once in a while to get down into Bethel, on down to Dillingham. And then we also had a sky van stationed in Bethel, and three twin otters in Bethel doing the village service there.
Okay.
So, you just went out. You'd go out for 7 days, and then you'd get 3 days at home.
And then you'd go back out for
seven days. Yeah.
So it's kind of like happens now, except no rotation. You're really gone more than you're home.
You were 3 days in and 7 days out. You know,
and you didn't know where you were going.
It wasn't
like you went back to Bethel every time.
Yeah. One time you'd go to Bethel,
one time they say we need you up in Lonely.
Right.
And Lonely, you're living on the Air Force base then.
Well, the Air Force had given it up pretty much. You know, they still had their, at that period of time, the satellite business had taken over the microwave, so the scope dopes and that kind of crew weren't there anymore. They're all in some center, and everything's being relayed to them so it was basically just an outfit called Husky, a Canadian outfit, was doing the support for all of these, and we were
just keeping them.
Yeah, we'd haul supplies out to the drill rigs and then haul all their trash back.
What were you landing on when you were out? Were you landing on frozen lakes or?
If frozen lakes in the wintertime, most of them had a strip. Didn't need a hell of a lot of strip for the sky van.
That's what I hear.
It's
800 feet or?
Yeah, it depends. If you're light, you know. Yeah. If full load, you might want 1,600 foot, you know.
Okay.
If you were all up full gross.
That's still free. And it doesn't have to be super well packed. That can be a rough
strip. We had big high flotation tires on it.
Yeah. God, see, that would have been fun.
Oh, that was the best job ever. I was never home, you know.
Yeah, how'd that affect the home life?
There was a lot of snarling and growling.
Yeah.
That's
a.
Some people are smart enough to do that. I never was quite. I never quite had it figured out.
After having talked to several, you know, quite a few pilots now, not quite a few, but enough. Depending on the work you're doing, that's a pretty common theme. That you're gone a lot.
Yeah.
And it can be hard on the home life. And there are a few flying jobs where you are home.
Yeah.
But they're.
Well, that was right here. That's what I'm doing. What I did here to.
Yeah. Yep. So you were living in Nome.
Yep.
So how'd you? So you're at Gifford, and then you came back to Nome.
I ended up going to work for Bering Air, as a matter of fact. Alaska Airlines was coming back into the bush, and they made a deal with Bering Air to do their village service.
Oh, so this was with Jim Rowe.
With Jim Rowe.
Okay.
Yep. And so. I got back on with them, and I opened up. I was actually the station manager for their station in Kotzebue.
Oh, you were up in Kotz.
Yep.
Okay.
So when we opened that up, I was the Kotzebue guy. We had a 207 and a Navajo at Kotzebue, and we just had lots of fun. I just really liked Kotzebue, but poor wife. My wife's a Nomite, you know, and
yeah,
she was a good sport, but but every time I see her, she'd say, "When the heck are we moving back to Nome?" Yeah.
Was Janice around at this point?
Yeah. Yep. Janice and Don were with us up there.
Yeah,
yep.
I know she went to school in Kotzebue
quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep, things were going really, really, actually quite good. That was a real good tour. And then I got this chance to go fly a jet.
That's right, you end up with a...
It had its good side and it had its positive side, you know.
This was the DC-9 at
DC-9, yeah. Yeah. A friend of mine I'd flown with was now the chief pilot for Evergreen's international part, 121.
Yeah.
And he asked me if I was interested in why.
How could you say?
The trouble with it is, you see, I didn't even ask my poor wife. Or anybody. I didn't consult with anybody. I just said, yeah. You know, I mean, how to really make things work out smooth, you know. Anyway, I got into that. Boy, the training was super, and the commuting wasn't worth a darn.
How was the plane?
Oh, they just had super maintenance. Everything was just way above, and it was really a nice job. Didn't have to commute.
And it was the DC-9.
DC-9, yeah, a little 32 series. It was an Alitalia DC-9. They were come out of the factory with a combi rig with a door that built it in the factory. That way they had military pallets, and then they had a walkway down the right side of the fuselage with the military pallet where they could get back to the passengers and the keep.
Okay. So, and was that mainly, was that international or just in the U.S.?
That way, the DC-9s were just the U.S.
Okay.
The airline was international, but the little DC-9s were doing what they call airlog contract with the military. So
okay.
We flew stuff for the military around.
The lower 48, not so much out of here.
Right. It was Ogden, Utah was a... Hill Air Force Base, I believe it is one of the places we were at, and then another place would be a Wright Pat. We had a airplane that would set there, and out of Warner Robins, out by Macon, Georgia, in that area out there,
so
was another spot. Oak City was another spot, and
that's a long commute.
Yeah, and you know, I really couldn't complain. You get off the airplane at Dayton there. You run down to the main airport and hop on in the evening and catch I believe it was a Piedmont, had a flight, 737, went nonstop to San Francisco. And you get off there just in time to catch a Air Cal out of San Francisco to Seattle. And you get into Seattle just in time to catch the Alaska Airlines freighter out of Seattle to Anchorage. And you got in Anchorage just in time to catch the morning flight out of Anchorage going into Nome. So, you know, in the night's time, you'd be from Dayton to Kotzebue, you know, and
overnight.
Be home overnight.
Well, that's not too bad.
Well, then three or four days going back.
Yeah.
And then you left your gear there because you expect you're going back, and then on the way back, you know you got to be in. So now you got to have...
You got to have two sets of gear that are with you.
Five or six sets of gear.
Yeah. Did they have a regular schedule for you, or if they kind of like, we need you, you're working till we don't need you?
No, they had a day. It was another one of those 6 days. See, 6 days on and 7 days off, I believe it was.
Oh,
something
so
like that. Yeah.
Yeah, just not a lot of time off
right.
in commuting.
Right. Yeah.
So you did that for about a year.
I told the boss that, hey, I can't do this anymore. When you have to send me for recurrent, I'm going home. Yeah,
and
don't bother.
Too hard home life.
Yeah.
It's like time to be back.
Yeah.
That's when he came back up here.
Yeah, just, and never looked back. This is much, much better.
Yeah.
Home every night. Yeah.
And in terms of the flying between here and the jet flying,
flying's the same. It don't matter whether it's a J3 Cub or a 747. All you got to do is think about the mass that you're riding around in, and what you got to do to get the mass direction changed, and that's about the only difference, you know. So it just is important to fly.
Push forward, it goes down.
Yep.
Pull back, it goes
yep,
up.
Yep.
Like
yep.
Janice used to say, tells a story about how you wouldn't fly at the autopilot. You'd keep it turned off, and you'd be there eating your soup or whatever, you'd be just steering with your feet, and the captain would get all pissed off.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, Vic, I can't tell if you got the autopilot on or not. Turn the damn thing off.
Yeah, they're just, that was always a deal cooking there. Yeah, that one day we went out, God, I wanted to hand fly the airplane, and the captain got so damn mad, he says, okay, that's it. You don't fly any, I'll just do all the flying, you just sit there. Oh, gee, you're the boss, all right. And the next morning we went out and the autopilot was deferred. I got to fly all day. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So when you came back up here, you didn't go back to, we left off, you were at Bering Air.
Yeah, I went back to Kotzebue.
In Bering Air, okay.
With Bering Air. And,
still managing and wrenching a little bit and flying a little bit.
Yeah.
I know you ended up with...
In a little bit of a tiff with Bering Air, a little bit, made probably the biggest mistake I ever made in my career, and I flew off the handle and quit. I gave them 2 weeks' notice, but I gave the wrong guy 2 weeks' notice.
Oh, okay.
You know, I didn't give the right guy 2 weeks' notice.
I did that once,
and when Jim Rowe found out about it, my 2 weeks was pretty well up, and I'd already had a new job lined up.
Oh, yep.
Yep.
That burned a little bridge.
That was the biggest mistake I've ever made. But anyway, did it and went to work for Ryanair, and that was excellent job. I really, really enjoyed that. We had a good manager there.
That was in the, are we in the 80s now?
Kind of losing track of the years here. I'd have to get a logbook out to remember. But
it was prior to their incident in Kenai.
Right.
I think they were booming.
Yep. Yeah, they sure were. And, Joe Amarok was the agent there. My God, he really knew how to keep me busy, boy. And I was that was also a good job. That was
it sounds good. Having just gone through Ryan Ground School, kind of gotten the history of Ryanair.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty interesting because, Boyack's father used to run the mail out of Unicleat.
Yep.
With a dog sled team.
Yep. Yep.
And he'd hike it in the summer.
Yep.
And that's, they're still hauling mail.
Yep.
It's pretty cool. Was Jim working at Ryanair, Jim Tweedo, when you were there?
I
know he started at Ryanair.
He's claimed several times that I checked him out in the 402, but I think he had me mixed up with Warren Thompson.
Oh, okay.
Warren Thompson was doing the 402 training.
I don't know how he'd mix you up with Warren Thompson.
Yeah, I don't know. old farts, I guess. Anyway, I did.
They're flying passengers.
Jim's brother,
Ron.
Ron, I met Ron while I was there. I got stuck in the fog, and I didn't have enough. I went back to Shaq Tulik, trying to get into Unicleat, and I was. Down there, no
Ron
fuel.
And
Ron was living in Shaq Tulik, and I borrowed some, I can't remember how much fuel it was, so I wanted to have enough fuel to where I could go down and take a crack at Unicleat and still make it back someplace else just in case I couldn't get in, you know.
Right, yeah.
And Ron gave me the fuel there, and
well, that's cool.
Yeah.
So you've kind of hit all the airlines up here.
Yeah.
That's
horrible. Yeah, when Ryan was shut down, that was kind of catastrophic. Just bam, just like that.
Well, they were huge.
Yeah.
They were a big air.
That was
40 or 50 planes. And,
yep. Anyway, Baker Aviation picked me up. They They were on their way up at that time. Yeah,
they were. Airlines here do that, don't they? Kind of.
Yep. I got on the rise there, and I started off as a line pilot with them, and I ended up. What's the Peter factor? You move yourself up to the point of
your point of incompetence.
Incompetence. Yeah, I was all the way up to a director of operations, and big pain in the rear for FAA. Really, I just not smart enough to really know how to put the job together right. But anyway, did the best I could, best I knew how. And ended up hiring another guy to take that director of operations job. And then they started an operation back in Nome, and that made family all happy. I came back down to Nome and just flew as a line pilot for them down here in Nome.
Nice being a line pilot, isn't
it? Yeah. Especially after being a... Man, that chief pilot and director of operations, they're like being in the center of a triangle. You got the feds, you got the management, and you got the employees, and you're right in the center of the big triangle, dodging and trying to deflect.
They're all throwing crap at you.
Yeah.
Trying to stay out of the way.
Yeah, trying to keep all that stuff under control. You're just crazy.
Yeah, I just talked to J.R. Beans. He's back just flying the line.
Yeah.
He seems a lot more relaxed.
Yeah.
it's good to be a line pilot.
Yep. That's a tough spot.
So you were with Baker's, then you ended up at Smythe.
Well, yeah, Baker's,
they kind of
he went a pretty good operation going there for a while. That was while I did that Russia trip.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we went over to Providenia, and I don't want to say against the Russians,
That was a little disorganized.
Just definitely a different way, the attitude and everything was just different. They learned to do things different than I grew up. It just happens that all during the Cold War, when I was at home and hearing my father talk about it, he says, the Russians aren't the enemy, it's the Chinese. They're going to come and get us. True, he was. Here the only thing is they're not doing it with cannons; they're doing it with dollars. Yeah, but anyway, so I grew up not having a war with the Russians. And when I went over there, the thing that struck me is the way. We spent all this money defending ourselves from this, huh?
Yeah.
What, we're all a bunch of stupid. Worked on B-36s that come up here and go into a holding pattern and fly for a day or two and in a holding pattern just waiting with more firepower in the bomb bay than the whole Second World War blew off,
And you look at Siberia, that area to Kamchatka, there's not a lot there.
Yeah, we're all crazy. But anyway, the people were just absolutely super over there.
Cool. And the people there are similar to the people here.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't even know what they're native Russians, or I don't know what they would...
Mostly Russians and then natives. They had a military base there.
Okay, so you had, like, the Russian Russians, but then you had, like, the, I guess they'd be, you'd go by the language, Yupiks, or...
The Russian language, yeah, of course.
But, we're calling them native Alaskans here, but you had the same...
Yeah, the same natives over there. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and I didn't know what they wanted.
At one time, before we were throwing rocks at each other, they were just rowing across any time they wanted. Relatives on both sides. Yeah.
So it's kind of related.
Yeah.
Huh. So you're going to Providenia, and we were talking that briefly. It was kind of like you were sort of doing like a mini contract between.
The real interesting part was they had troubles getting supplies in Providenia. Go in there and the shelves and the stores are just bleak. There'd be a couple of cans here and a couple of cans there and a little package here. And the stores had, the people there had money. Kind of amazing. They had a lot of U.S. dollars cash. That was really amazing.
Do they have, is it the natural resources they have, gold, or?
They're just, it's all smarter than me. I wasn't smart enough to keep up with it. I'm just busy trying to think about how to make it back and forth without making too big of mistakes with the airplane,
This would have been the 90s, by by now. Yeah. Early 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was still the Soviet Union, you know.
Oh, so it's still the 80s at that
time. Yeah.
Late
yeah,
80s,
they were, they come out and meet us with rifles, you know, when we came in.
But friendly.
But the stores over there were trying to get supplies, and they figured out that they could order bypass to Nome. And then our station manager would stockpile it there. We'd get a load that would go on the 40. We'd make 3 or 4 trips a week with all groceries for these store owners over there.
In the 402.
In the 402. Yeah. I guess I was telling you the story about trying to get the DC-3 to start really getting into this.
Really ramp it up.
But, people don't get to where they don't trust each other, and that all fell apart. We quit going back and forth. Baker started having troubles with financial problems like most airlines. So it all kind of come to an end.
It seems, they struggled. Everyone sort of goes through moments. I mean, the Baker family, I know, is still pretty big. John Baker is one of the Iditarod now.
Yeah.
So they're still hanging in there as a family. Yeah,
right. Well, they're a great family. They're great people. It just, it's tough, you know. It's awful easy to make a mistake. The profit margin in this industry is pretty bleak, you know. I mean, and the slightest little mistake or misjudgment, and you can't dig your way out of it.
And you can lose really fast.
Yes.
You
can
lose lots of money quick. Yep,
really, really quick. Yeah.
So the 402s at that point were kind of like the plane out here.
Yeah, the 402s and the Navajos, they were working each other to death. Yeah.
Now it's the caravans and the caravans.
Yeah.
A caravan's a cost us to a lot now, too.
Yeah, I got caught sideways with the with Baker's there. I ended up quitting and I got on with, I thought I was going to take some time off. I kind of wore out. I was really, really burnt out pretty bad. I had it figured I was just going to take a month of doing nothing. And
how'd that work for you?
I got a phone call the next day and said, "Hey, Vic, you want to come over here to Fairbanks and fly Navajos?" Well, I'd already had Navajo time with Bering Air. I'll try that. You really do need some income. I'm not really this flush. So I went over there and flew for summer in Fairbanks for Frontier.
Okay.
And then there was a pilot here for Cape Smythe. We had a schedule, Fairbanks to Nome.
Huh.
So I come over, I get on that every once, and I use that to commute, I was two weeks on and 2 weeks off on that job, which was really pretty good.
Yeah, two on, two off based in Fairbanks, that's
pretty good. Yeah, definitely. Come home here for a bit,
Yeah.
We were going to move to Fairbanks, but family conditions changed, and that kind of went out the window. So I wanted to get back to Nome again, and so another pilot here for Cape Smythe, and I just basically switched jobs.
Instead of being the guy jump seating back and forth, you were the guy flying the flying the Navajo back and forth.
Yeah. And anyway, he ended up taking my job over there, and I took his job here, and we just kind of made a swap, and I was back in Nome again.
Callan and I did that with Everett's.
Oh yeah,
he went and took my 46 slot. I gave him his 406 slot. That seems to still work out here.
Yep.
And then,
I flew Cape Smythe. I was a station manager for a period of time. It was a pretty good job. I got along real good with. Well, I thought I got along real good with.
The Grant.
With trying to think of I can't remember the gentleman's name up there in Barrow that retired. He was the original director of operations. The director of ops, when he retired.
Oh, I know. They're just talking to somebody about this.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah, I can't think of it. Don Henley was the chief pilot at one point.
No, this was way before him.
Oh, way before, okay. Yeah. Grant Thompson, you might be predating everything I know about them.
Anyway, when the old man retired up there in... He didn't invent the bear. He engineered the invention of the bear. That's the way that he ran the company. He didn't do anything except for make sure everybody underneath him had everything they needed to get their job done.
Oh, that's actually...
Yes.
That's excellent managing stuff.
That he was the probably one of the smartest director of operations I've ever worked for.
Yeah. That's
and when he retired, everything I liked about the company retired with him.
Yeah.
It just, the new people that took over, they were just...
They weren't your
different.
Your people.
We just had different views of what was going on.
Yeah.
I opened my mouth up wrong a couple of times and, yeah.
Airlines up here, seeing you, they're so dependent upon who's running them.
Yeah.
And they'll change the whole personality of the airline will change quite a bit depending who comes and goes.
But about that time, Haglund needed a pilot.
The new up-and-coming airline came to town.
So I popped on with Haglund. That was the best move. Haglund's has been just absolutely super.
They really have. And I've played around a lot looking at different things and... looking at the operation they run, and even now just being over there, they run a good operation.
Yeah.
I mean, you can nitpick stuff and always find something wrong.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's a pretty darn good deal. They pay decent.
Yep.
They
just treated me super, man. I just...
Yeah.
Just really, really...
But Jim, Ron, and Mike were just really good people.
Yep.
So, So you worked for Haglund, you still do. You do ground schools for them.
I go out and help the mechanics out a little bit off and on when
you're back wrenching again.
Yep.
We never really stopped.
No, I never really stopped. And then I got this hanger here, I got this 175 all tore apart in here right now. There was a little couple of spots that had some corrosion, and we're tearing the corrosion out of it. And
so you never really retired.
No, I still keep my first class flight physical up.
Nice.
I'm still current in the airplanes out here. But
that's what I hear. When I heard you were retiring a couple of years ago, I was like, yeah, right, that's never going
to
happen.
It is nice, though, because I can kind of
pick and choose.
Sometimes I kind of sleep in the morning. And you know, this Alaska, get in trouble here. I think it was Sheffield was the governor of the Sheffield, Alaska daylight savings time puts us 3 hours ahead of the sun.
Oh, here. Yeah.
High noon is 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
I think you're actually guiding on Denali. We run into that. I was working with a Kiwi guide he's just climbed all over the world. And we were talking about when to start. And he's like, well, we got to look at the, cool start so the glacier would be frozen. It's like, well, we're in Alaska, so we don't want to leave at, midnight's not the coolest time.
Right.
It's like 3 in the morning.
Right. Yep. You got to consider that. All the critters out there in the countryside watching us take off early in the morning, wonder what in the world is with these guys. Huh?
Yeah, we should be going to bed at midnight or 1.
Yeah. So I kind of, that's kind of where I'm at right now. If somebody wants to get me real early in the morning, they're kind of... They're not going
to
get much response, but
better to get you
about 10 or 11 o'clock, I kind of start crawling out of the woodwork and get out, and I hang around till about 7 o'clock out here.
When you still have your own cub?
Yeah, I do. PA-12.
You've been working on for?
But yeah, I've been rebuilding it since. Gosh, I kind of lose track. But I completely rebuilt that thing. It's been completely torn down and build all the way up from the ground up.
It's the blue and white one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty. When I was running the other day, I stopped to look at it.
Yeah, it sure needs a worse job right now, all the dust and everything on it. But that's
still a good-looking cup. Yeah, you put some good work into that.
Yeah.
Huh, so this is going to keep running the maintenance shop here? And
Whatever I can, I got a little teeny tiny bit of Social Security and that kind of stuff rolling in.
And stay in Nome and fly your cup and go out fishing.
You just tough out the winters just so you can get a couple of months out here beating around the Seward Peninsula.
Will you still go skiing in the winters?
A little bit. Not as much as I used to. What I really like is that taking the PA-12 out and then with my skis in the back of it and then seeing some... You can really get around the country there.
Yeah, you could go 50, 60, 80, 100 miles away and go for a ski trip.
Yep.
Way out. So airplane skiing.
Right. Airplane skiing, yeah.
That's my family. I want to be an airplane climber. I want to get my own plane at some point. I bought that Luscombe with the idea that I'd fly into the mountains, and it just, the Luscombe just wasn't a mountain snow ski plane. But that'd be great. Yeah, you land somewhere, go climb something, or go skiing, and then fly home.
Went out this spring. The caribou in the area up here in the Seward Peninsula to protect the reindeer herds. They've got encouraging hunters to go out and get, and disturb the caribou. Anyway, you can fly and shoot this. You can land and get right out. You got to be 100 foot away from the airplane to shoot. You know,
they're trying to keep the population down or keep them moving or something. Yeah,
boy, they're just a monster herd of caribou. It's just mind-boggling. But anyway, that gets them interesting, landing on the hillsides like you're talking about. Then get a, you know, a hike off over the hill and shoot a caribou, and then you hike back over to your airplane, and you've already figured out where you can land where the carcass is at, so you don't have to pack it and come back and, you know, land on, pretty amazing the places you can land with that airplane with skis. Kind of.
I bet. Yeah, I haven't flown a cub on skis. I haven't flown a cub that much.
Yeah.
Before we finish up here, do you have any just like advice or recommendations for someone who might be coming up to Alaska to fly?
Yeah, don't do anything that anybody's going to want to write a story about.
That's actually, I was thinking of that with Doug, and you've kind of had a career too where this is, you've just had a long time in this industry, that, but it's been very sort of low key.
Yep, stay out of trouble.
Stay out of trouble,
Yep. Don't do anything. And, you know, you don't do anything to scare anybody, namely yourself.
Yeah, if you're getting scared, then your passengers, you're not doing your passengers any favors.
Yeah,
cool. Excellent. Well, thanks for thanks for sharing the story.
Yep, you're welcome.
We hope you liked this interview. Visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.